Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes athletic and recreational opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Andrea Carey from Sport for Life. So tell me a little bit about Sport for Life.
Sport for Life is a leader around physical literacy development and quality sport. And we do training and advocacy work to support people offering quality programs in communities.
And can you tell me a little bit about some of the disability programs that exist within?
So Sport for Life developed the long-term athlete development pathway in 2004. And there's two stages associated with that pathway that are specifically for encouraging people with disabilities to participate in sport and physical activity opportunities. Those are awareness and first involvement. And with awareness, it's introducing people to what opportunities exist for them to be involved in sport and physical activity. And first involvement is ensuring that they have a positive first experience and want to continue to participate. So in the work that Sport for Life does on a regular basis, we incorporate those stages and the philosophy of ensuring that everyone has an entry point into sport and physical activity throughout all of our trainings and work that we do. And in particular, we have a workshop called Inclusive Physical Literacy, which is around supporting individuals with all abilities to be involved in sport and physical activity programming.
So, what types of disabilities do you most commonly see?
So we work across a variety of with a variety of different organizations who support different disabilities, and so we have a strong relationship with the Canadian Paralympic Committee, supporting individuals with physical disabilities. And within that, we also work with local clubs and provinces around supporting those individuals along their pathway and journey to being a Paralympic athlete. And then we do work around some sensory disabilities, like vision impairment and deaf and hard of hearing. And then we also do quite a bit of work with Special Olympics, so for people with intellectual disabilities. And then lately we're doing more and more work around partnering with groups that are supporting children with autism and different behavior issues.
So are there any challenges in this advocacy work?
Well, there's many challenges. Many of the organizations we work with are not-for-profit, as are we, so people are always challenged by funding issues and trying to find funding to support the work that they're doing. In addition, we end up all kind of vying for some of the same dollars, so often there's challenges around trying to work on collaboration. And currently one of the projects I'm working on with Jumpstart, the Canadian Tire Charity, is to bring a variety of different organizations who are offering trainings together to create an e-learning platform where all of the content that they have could be shared nationally and without barriers for those frontline leaders to have appropriate training to be able to support any ability that comes across a program that they might be offering.
So, to look at the converse side of things, in your time with this work, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Oh, I think there's many success stories. I mean, if you look back historically, we didn't really even offer opportunities for individuals with disabilities to participate in sport and physical activity a few years ago. And so there's a growing trend around the different types of sports that are offered and the adaptations and modifications that can be put into place so that everyone has an opportunity to play. And so I think that's a fantastic step forward. And I think some of the work that I just referenced with Jumpstart will actually really enhance the opportunities for people with disabilities going forward. And when we look at our recent success at the Paralympics in Pyeongchang, Canada had the most medals it's ever had at Winter Games. So we are certainly seeing lots of success factors, and people with disabilities have more opportunities to be active than ever. But, you know, in parallel, they also face some of the same challenges that people without disabilities face in terms of time and transport and finances to participate. Some of those impact them even more because they have additional barriers in their life. And so we just need to constantly be looking at how we can mitigate those barriers and ensure that they have the best opportunity possible to participate.
So, if you could send any message about the need for equal inclusion in sport, what would you say?
Just always start with thinking about how you can be inclusive and not kind of be afraid to tackle whatever those challenges or barriers might be to being inclusive. And I know that it can be intimidating or daunting when someone shows up with a disability and you don't really know what to do, but there's so many fantastic resources out there, and you know, always happy to connect people to what some of those are. And there's lots of amazing organizations doing work to support people with disabilities participating, so there's just no shortage of resources. So look around, figure out where you can go for help, and then figure out how you can best support that individual to meet their optimum potential.
So, with the Jumpstart project, what do you most hope to see come out of that?
Out of the Jumpstart project, Jumpstart's investing $50 million over 5 years in supporting individuals with disabilities across Canada to have more opportunities to participate in sport and physical activity. The e-learning that I referenced earlier is one of those opportunities, and I think that it will just really amplify the trainings that do exist and hopefully give people a central place to go to find out what they need to know to best support individuals with different abilities in their program. So my hope is that it starts to minimize the confusion and sort of the not knowing for those frontline leaders that are looking for how they can best support individuals.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yep.
In this next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Natalie Babin Defresne from the Human Rights Commission. Tell me a little bit about some of the Human Rights Commission's work involving people with disabilities.
Well, the Canadian Human Rights Commission has essentially two mandates, two responsibilities. It receives complaints from individuals who do have difficulties, whether it be with accessibility or having their rights respected when it comes to their disabilities. And we also have a promotion role. So it's getting out there and talking to people and raising awareness about human rights and the impact that can have on people's lives.
So what are some of the common complaints you hear, some of the barriers people with disabilities are facing?
Right. Well, some of the common issues, well, I guess what we can do is take a look back and say at the Human Rights Commission, about half of all of our complaints are related to disability issues. And so it makes up a large proportion of the work that we have when it comes to people experiencing discrimination. Now, within that 50%, 40% of them are related to mental health disability. So again, another big chunk of the work, and shows kind of the almost an even split when it comes to physical disability and barriers or physical barriers experienced by those individuals, as well as what we call the more invisible disabilities that are a little bit harder for people to be aware of them. And so because of that, we get a range of different types of obstacles and issues and challenges that people will face. Most of our complaints are related to employment. So it's in regards to getting a job or accommodation when they're in their job, et cetera. So we have issues regarding, accommodation of disabilities in the workplace, physical and mental disabilities. It could be substance dependence. So how is the employer accommodating someone who has a substance dependence issue? We see stuff regarding non-accessible services in banking or transportation, for instance. We often see complaints as well related to technology, so technology not being accessible in the workplace or for a specific service that's being provided. We could think of, for instance, voting and the accessibility around that as well, or technologies that are being adopted for that. So there's a range of different types of obstacles that people experience.
So do you ever find that a person with a disability might be hesitant to come forward and speak to you folks in regards to what they're facing?
Absolutely. I think that is not simply a concern for people with disabilities. I think it's writ large anyone who's experienced discrimination or harassment based on their human rights. It is a very personal issue, and it can take a lot of courage for someone to, take that first step and try to defend themselves when it comes to the discrimination that they're facing. And someone with a disability who might be dealing with a range of other obstacles when it comes to their employment or services that they want, it might not just be one thing, and it's hard to pin down. And so that can create a barrier as well about how easy it is for people to make a complaint. It's one of the things that we've tried to change at the commission is to make it easier for someone to make a complaint. And so this year, the Canadian Human Rights Commission has put online its complaint form. And it might seem like a simple change, because we're used to having everything online now, but even that small gesture, making it that much easier for people who might be intimidated by the process. They might not want to pick up a phone or fill out by hand a questionnaire, that they got by the mail. They can do it in the comfort of their home on the computer, and it might give them a sense of being able to protect a little bit of their personal story. And so those are little changes that we've tried to put in place so that people will feel a little bit more comfortable about coming forward, because every person who comes forward, and when that becomes public and when people know about it, it sometimes gives courage to others to come forward as well. People feel a safety in numbers, and so that can help move issues forward.
So do you find, from an employer's standpoint, sometimes these issues are just related to a lack of education, that they simply don't know what should be in place?
Absolutely. I think in a lot of cases, employers want to do the good thing, and they want to do the right thing. They just don't know what that is exactly. We all live, incredibly busy lives, and it's divided into so many different priorities. And the job we have at the commission, and we all do, quite frankly, as individuals, is to point out when we see that something can be improved, and to help people that we know that might be facing barriers to be their voice as well, and to bring that up so that we raise that level of awareness not only with employers but within our families and schools and neighborhoods. But definitely employers do seek out that information. We see that just with the information that's on our website. It's incredibly informative and popular information that's related to what employers can do to help make things easier for everyone. And it's it's an education not just about what they can do, but it's education also about how it's not sometimes as difficult as people might think it is, or as costly as people might think it is. Definitely one of the barriers that we've seen when it comes to employers is this perhaps perception that accommodation is too expensive, and that's why they're not doing it. When in actuality, sometimes, most of the time, changes can be done in a way that don't create such a hard, such a high burden on the employer.
So, in your time working with the commission, has there been any success case that stands out for you? Someone you were able to help get the appropriate resolution, perhaps?
Well, cases or complaints often fall into two categories. We have complaints that are very individual in nature, and so specific to the particular person at hand, and it helps them and it creates resolution in their story. And then we have more systemic cases. So it's one person who's coming forward with a complaint, but it represents something that a host of people, an entire group, is experiencing. And getting those changes brought will actually help an entire community. And so it goes beyond the experience of one particular individual. And so we try to balance at the commission those two needs so that when we are helping individuals, we try as much as possible to make decisions in the public interest so that everyone, whether it be in the disability community or any of the other communities that we serve, will benefit from it. And so some of the cases or some of the things that we're trying to do is not just focus on those cases, which help advance human rights, absolutely, but also on the individual stories. For instance, this past year, we actually just published our annual report for 2017. And in it, we have decided to put a lens on actual stories. They're not just the complaints, but bringing attention to people who are doing amazing work out there to help raise the bar when it comes to accessibility. And there's a story in our annual report this year regarding a young woman called Sydney who has a disability, a physical disability, that's making it very hard for her to go to school and to find a school setting that could respond to her needs for her to continue her schooling. And so what we see as our role in the commission is resolving those complaints and bringing those forward so that we have the jurisprudence, the legal arena keeps moving forward, but also that we use the visibility that we have as an organization to shed light on the stories as well. Might not be a complaint, but these are individuals who are certainly making a change as well and helping to move things forward.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Of course.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Canadian Blood Services invites you to save a life today. Every 60 seconds, someone in Canada needs blood. Donating is simple, and your blood will go to help Canadians undergoing heart surgery, leukemia treatment, or those involved in an accident. Go online and book your appointment today at www.blood.ca or give us a call toll-free at 1-888-2-DONATE. That's 1-888-236-6283.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes athletic and recreational opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Andrea Carey from Sport for Life and Natalie Babin Dufresne from the Human Rights Commission. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Susan Hardy, an expert on the UN Convention for Individuals with Disabilities. Now, before we begin, I'd like it noted that our good friend Marcia Ryu of Disability Rights Promotion International helped arrange this interview. Through her amazing work, I've seen the power of the convention. It's changing lives, not just here at home, but it's changing lives on an international setting. And it was my honor to have a chance to speak to someone involved with just making it work. So tell me a little bit about your experiences regarding the UN Convention.
Well, I was actually involved on the front end and supposed to go to New York for the meetings that were going to informing and developing the UN that ended up informing UNCRPD. And then I went back to school and I re-engaged in a research capacity here at CCDS as research. We have a knowledge hub and it's grounded in UNCRPD and social justice frameworks. So we're really doing a total restructuring of our organization to make sure that our work is supporting the possible strategy around UNCRPD, as well as the monitoring and maybe some best practices around how to implement.
So in the years since the charter was signed, how have you seen disability rights progress?
Well, I guess the thing is I think with somehow the discussion has become about disability issues and a disability movement, and somehow we've lost the right dialogue. So I guess for us right now, and talking with some other stakeholders, there's a real need to reinfuse discussions around human rights, including UNCRPD, our own charter rights, in the disability discourses, inclusive of mental health.
So what are some of the most common barriers facing people with disabilities, mental health included?
I think I can refer you, there's just been 8 alliances that did some really great consultations, and they're major reports on all of the barriers faced by people with disabilities. On the Spinal Cord Injury of Canada website, I kind of wrote down some notes around some of the barriers to the uptake or indicators for me around UNCRPD. I think there needs to be quite a comprehensive educational piece done around UNCRPD, starting with many of the federal, provincial, territorial service groups or departments, because I don't know that people understand the UNCRPD and what that may mean within their work settings. Also, I think there needs to be education within the diverse disability communities around UNCRPD, so that should people be engaged in any kind of local, regional, provincial, territorial, federal levels, they could actually be drawing that into their discussions. Because I really see a lack of knowledge about UNCRP as a very front-end issue. There might be changes, some modifications in employment, in addressing poverty. From our perspective, CCDS, the whole piece around we're using an intersectional approach, so we want to be gathering data which is desegregated that would allow us to see what segment of the disability communities are actually benefiting and to what degree. I think there's quite a push on an international minimal data set gathering internationally. I'm a bit concerned that it actually will take us back instead of forward and aligned with UNCRPD as the social model of disability.
So, in your time researching disability rights and the Charter in particular, Has there been any success that's come from the UNCRPD? Anything you've witnessed that would really stand out for you?
You know, prior to coming to CCDS, I was primarily working in mental health. And I can't say that it's been embraced there in any substantive way. In fact, you know, not all people with mental health issues and intellectual disabilities are actually covered by Canada signing on to UNCRPD with their opting out in Article 12 around supported decision making. And I think, yeah, so from my perspective, there's been an exclusion of an entire subpopulation that we need to address from the mental health perspective. And yeah, so I think part of, so it's been quite a time. I think it takes time for people in position of power to understand the potential positive benefit of embracing UNCRPD and developing a strategy around it. And I do think, you know, like our some provinces, there's three provinces now, I believe, Ontario, Manitoba, and Nova Scotia that have their own accessibility legislation. And so, and they're all having, I can speak to Ontario, hearing significant issues around compliance from them being grounded in a customer model. So UNCRPD is grounding in its human rights component and us signing on to optional protocol. And if we also get rid of the reservation Article 12, we'll have a really strong status to appeal if we can't get some traction in our communities in Canada to actually appeal to the UN for support. So, you know, the UN basically, when we reported this year, they gave back three areas to work on, girls and young women, intersectionality, and around the area of supported decision making. So the area of exclusion, but it really directed Canada to get rid of that exclusion.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
As I said, the UNCRPD is a very powerful document. It's a matter of life change. However, any legislation that can't stand up to scrutiny isn't worth its salt. The fact is, we can't just rest on our laurels and say, we put this in place, yay, ain't we great. No, there's always room to take that next step forward. There's always the question to be asked, can we do better by this? Someone once said, the law should never be stagnant. It's true of any legislation concerning advocacy. But really, there's no way to make anything 100% accessible. There's always going to be some exception. It's important for people with disabilities to also remember people are trying. They are taking note. The fact that a world stage would recognize that these are people of potential and capability as well, that really does speak volumes. When I approached Marcia about doing this interview, she was very happy to put me in touch with a couple of sources connected to the Charter. And honestly, her work through DRPI is also about global change. It's about recognizing that no matter what land separates us, as a people, we are in fact one. We all have the same hopes for a better tomorrow. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.